The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
It was on regular rotation most weekends. I don't even know how many times I've seen Stand By Me, but it's been many.
The terrible Australian B. Jemine.
And he pretty much just yells out, misery's alive, misery's alive. Oh, this whole house is going to be full of romance. Oh, I'm going to go put on some Liberace records. I don't know why that line just killed me for some reason.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
There's some serious going on. And here I'm like, the what is this? Why?
Mature themes.
King himself and also Mick Garrison, how they sort of stage how this virus sort of spreads and everything, was just very eerie and very unsettling for me.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the King's Own podcast from the Super Network at supermarcy.com. This is a podcast that takes a deep dive into the film and TV adaptations of the work of Stephen King. I'm your host, Super Marcy, and this is episode 24. We're going to take a journey of terror with season one of Chapel Waits. And I am joined by my regular co-host. He is the one who is terrible, Mr. Bede Jemine. Hello, Bede. How are you going?
I'm good, thanks, Marcy. How are you?
Doing very well. Maybe, maybe not. As we're doing this podcast, just a bit of knowledge for our listeners. The recording messed up, so we are having to redo this again.
Indeed.
But, you know, what would it be with a podcast on the Super Network if we did not have technical or just ridiculous issues? But, no, we are all good. We are ready to discuss Chapel Waits, which is based on the short story of Stephen King, Jerusalem's Lot. And that easily segues us into our guest for this episode. He is my co-host on this very podcast spin-off show, the King Zones Book Club podcast. And we covered Jerusalem's Lot on episode one. So please welcome Stephen T. Bolts. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm well. How are you?
Doing well. Glad that I pressed the record button, so that's all good.
See, Marcy, you're doing a bead right now. I just assumed I'd be the one who'd be messing up all of our recordings, but you definitely took advantage of that on this episode, even before as we started.
Yeah, I know. I'm doing so, so well. Wonderfully well. Oh, dear. Well, let's just say, having watched Chapel Waits, the opening credits for each episode scared the shit out of me a little bit, and maybe that's why I'm just on edge and recordings are just playing up today, but we will get to that in due time. I will go over the plot synopsis from IMDb because I am very terrible at summarizing something on my own, and we'll give the cast list and everything. So here we go, the plot synopsis for Chapel Waits season one.
Captain.
Dear Cousin Charles, by the time you receive this letter, I shall be in my final resting place. I bequeath you a magnificent ancestral home we call Chapel Waits.
What do you think? Hardly know what to say myself.
I hear you're looking for a governess.
We are.
Your family has a reputation.
Your children. Are they Christian?
Some blame Chapel Waits for the illness in town.
The Boones are surrounded by misfortune.
Father, are we safe here?
Once the people see that there's nothing to fear, this animosity will diminish.
Unless there is something to fear. I see things that aren't real.
Your feelings for him.
My feelings for all of them.
bad things are coming.
All that you believe is madness. That is my curse. Only I can save you.
In the 1850s, Captain Charles Boone relocates his family to his ancestral home in the small, sleepy town of Preacher's Corners. Charles will soon have to confront the secrets of his family's history and fight to end the darkness. Season 1 of Chapelwaite was developed for television by Jason Filardi and Peter Filardi, based on the short story Jerusalem's Lot by Stephen King. And it stars Adrian Brody, Emily Hampshire, Jennifer Innes, Serena Guliamgas, I think. Ian Ho, Hugh Thompson, Gord Rand, Trina Corcum, Devante Signor, Allegra Fulton, Eric Peterson, Michael Ho, Jennifer Raymond, Julian Riching, Stephen McCarthy, and Christopher Hyderall. And if I said any of those names wrong, I apologize. My pronunciation is very, very awful. Maybe I should be the terrible Australian. I don't know.
Yeah, you've been promoted to that now, Marcy.
I think I have been. After this episode, 100%, I'm now the terrible Australian. Yes. So very exciting season to talk about. And yes, well, we'll see if season 2 even relates to anything by Stephen King to make it relevant to discuss for this podcast. But as it sits now, we will discuss season 1. So, Beat, I will pick on you because I believe you haven't read the short story and were probably the one who was most unfamiliar with this. So what were your thoughts initially?
Yeah, I was kind of very curious when I sat down to watch Chapelwaite. Like, the only two things I sort of knew about the original short story that it was based on, Jerusalem's Lot, being that, A, it's a kind of a prequel story to the novel Salem's Lot. So that was kind of the first thing I knew. And, of course, you and Stephen talked about this short story in the debut episode of the King Zones Book Club podcast. So that was kind of the only kind of familiarity I had of this story. So I was kind of curious to see how it would translate into a 10-episode TV series. So, but what did keep my interest, though, was, of course, the talent that they assembled for the show, both in front and behind the camera, because you got Oscar winner Adrian Brody leading the cast, and also you got a stacked of pretty well-known sort of film and TV character actors in supporting roles. The series, which I find very interesting, was created by Jason and Peter Filardi. Now, both of these guys have pretty interesting screenwriting careers prior to this one. Jason Filardi, in particular, of course, wrote the comedy films Bringing Down the House and as well as 17 again with Zac Efron. But Peter Filardi, though, has definitely got more of the sort of the horror pedigree in his filmography, because he wrote the scripts to the original 1990 version of Flatliners and as well as The Craft. But also, Marcy, we've also talked about him before because he actually wrote the 2004 miniseries version of Salem's Lot. So this is him coming back to that universe of Salem's Lot. And now, we've talked about that miniseries before in a previous episode and how we weren't the biggest fans of it. So I was kind of a little apprehensive to see, like, how he would do with this story compared to, you know, the Stephen King novel. And I got to say, I was really pleasantly surprised by this whole TV series. Like, I will admit, I don't know if it necessarily needed to be 10 episodes long, because there were moments where it felt like the story kind of dragged a little bit, or it kind of just took a lot of time to sort of for the thrust of the story to get going. But that being said, though, I still found it a pretty engaging series from beginning to end. Also, because it's very atmospheric. There's a lot of creepy moments throughout. And also, there's some great performances throughout it as well. Like I said, Adrian Brody is great in the lead role of Captain Charles Boone, and all the supporting cast are all pretty top-notch in all of their roles. And I like how sort of how the series kind of brings a lot of complexity to all these characters that sort of make them very well-rounded as characters. And for me, that's kind of what made the series work overall. Like, again, it's creepy atmosphere. It's sort of, you know, it's fun vampire stuff. And also, even though, yeah, we're seeing, it has elements in this story that we've seen many times before, it still manages to be a pretty creepy and engaging series from beginning to end. And I also like that, like, since this, they would have to expand on the short story to make a 10-episode TV show. I did like that there were elements from other Stephen King stories we've seen before that were kind of weaving into the plot of this one. Particularly, there was an episode where we see Captain Charles Boone go completely mad, and it almost kind of reminded me a little bit of The Shining in a way. And we kind of get to see other episodes where it felt like certain Stephen King elements were just kind of threaded into the plot to kind of expand the story. And I think the series did a pretty good job with that. But yeah, like I said, overall, I found it overall to be a pretty surprisingly solid horror series.
And Steve, what are your initial thoughts on season one of Chapelwaite?
I was very, very interested in this from the start, because Jerusalem's Lot's one of my favorite King stories. So I was really intrigued. The first thing I'd heard was the synopsis that Adrian Brody was going to play Charles Boone, and that he and his children were moving to Chapelwaite. And right there with children, I was thrown. I was like, wow, okay, they're doing something different. Because Charles Boone in the story was probably 60 or 70, right? So this was really interesting to me in the first place. I knew they were going to be doing something different. Mm-hmm. And the story, not to sit here and compare and contrast the story to, you know, Bede and I had a conversation last week where he got my entire grievance about The Shining, you know, where it's different from the book and blah, blah, blah. But I think you've got to keep some fidelity to the source, right? And this one absolutely did that. At the end of every episode, I was left sort of going, okay, I see what they're doing. This is exactly the short story, but they've expanded it in a way that really sort of worked. I think of the series, The Haunting of Hill House, and what they did with that, right? They kept the story, they kept the main story, but just extrapolated. They went, you know, they created another story within that story. But with The Haunting of Bly Manor, they just sort of brought other story elements into the turn of the screw that didn't necessarily need to be there to get the story told, right? And I think Chapelwaite did it the way Hill House did it. I thought it was great. I got to say, I was a little annoyed that there were vampires in this thing, okay? Because Jerusalem's, I went over the story, like, you know, we went over the story, and there's one mention of Nosferatu in this, where Stephen Boone and Marcella, they're lurking in the house, they're sort of haunting the house as the undead, but there's no real vampiredom going on. There's no bloodsuckers happening there. And I thought this story with the book, De Vermis Mysterious, you had enough sort of mythology there, sort of your Lovecrafty mythology, that you didn't need the vampire thing. And I, god damn Peter Filardi for bringing the Salem's Lot mini into this. That's my big thing. Like, I loved it overall, but I've got little nitpickings, which we can get into as we go, as they come up. But I don't believe, like, Jerusalem's Lot, Bede, you mentioned before, sort of a prequel to Salem's Lot. But in reality, not so much, because it was written when King was in college, and you can't write the prequel before the thing that it's a prequel to. So, like, Jerusalem's Lot and Salem's Lot, to me, feel like they're in a multiverse. You know, the town of Jerusalem's Lot is fucked, whatever universe you're in, some bad shit's going down. An honest to God prequel to Salem's Lot would deal with Hubie Marston and or Mr. Barlow, which I'd love to see as well. But the bringing in the vampires in this will not ever connect directly to Salem's Lot, because there were no vampires in Salem's Lot until Mr. Barlow shows up, right? So this is sort of weird for me to think that this is going to connect. I think it was easy to fall back on vampires and not just do, you know, the horror that was written in the short story already, but to go, yeah, ooh, look, here's Nosferatu. Let's take that and just fucking run with it. Overall, though, like, I thought they did a fantastic job. I was just stunned by Adrian Brody. I know he's an Oscar winner. I know he's good. I've seen him in a lot, but I've never really, like, been, you know, ooh, Adrian Brody, right? He's fantastic in this. And now he's one of those guys who talks like this all the time.
Yes, he is.
You know, which I enjoyed. The cast, you mentioned the cast. There were guys in this who I'd seen places before but couldn't peg. The one that stood out for me was Philip Boone, played by the great Julian Richings. That guy is fantastic. Everything he shows up in. He has a history with King too. Wasn't he in Kingdom Hospital?
I believe so, yeah. I have to look up to confirm, but I wouldn't be surprised if he appeared in other Stephen King adaptations before.
Yeah, I haven't watched Kingdom Hospital yet, so I can't tell you.
Yeah, he's fantastic. And when he showed up, as soon as he showed up in the credits, I was like, oh, okay, I'm in. I'm in. I love this guy. He's in Supernatural. I think he plays the original Reaper, Grim Reaper, in that. And of course, the cult leader in Todd and the Book of Pure Evil, which is a brilliant show. If you guys haven't seen it, you should get on it. But I was very happy with this adaptation. I still have that sort of feeling when I get to the end of it with vampires. But yeah, really dug it.
And as for me, I guess after we covered the short story, I was very much in the mindset of, well, not in the mindset, but more like, well, how do they actually really expand this? I wasn't sure, I guess, what it would be like. And, you know, seeing Adrian Brody is the main character, so, okay, that's probably changed stuff a little bit. speaking of Julian Richings, he is in A Bag of Bones, we have not yet covered, but we will. I have not come across Kingdom Hospital yet on this list, so I don't know.
Yeah, I did check before he was in Kingdom Hospital.
Great.
I do remember we saw him in Urban Legend as the creepy dude.
Janitor, yes.
Yeah. I was really unsure essentially how they were going to do this. And I figured, they're going to have to like kind of world build this a little bit and all sorts. But yeah, as I started watching the first episode, it really drew me in. You really get a feel for the characters and I guess the grim nature of everything, and a lot of heavy things seem to hang over Charles Boone.
You alone witnessed both their deaths. No one else.
That's right.
Mrs. Cloris. I believe you're hiding something. I believe that Stephen is alive. Last night, you know what I did? I opened Stephen's grave. Do you know what I found? Nothing. So how do you explain that? Now, I was lured here under the pretense of an inheritance. To what end?
I wouldn't know.
Then you tell me what you do know. Where is Stephen Boone?
I couldn't say.
Oh, I think you could.
I beg you. Leave me in peace.
When you see my cousin, you tell him. You tell him I'm looking for him. I will find him.
Kind of expecting that the town was not going to be very welcoming of him, because usually they're not. You know, that's very much there. A lot of the people, and they really felt like Stephen King town's characters, very like, I'm so going to be overly religious and everything I do is going to be because of my religious belief. So a lot of that was very much in there. So I feel like it actually had a very King-esque feel to the whole thing. But yeah, I liked how they expanded the story. We go into this whole, you know, as Charles Boone learns about the family history and everything like that, which I found fascinating. And we sort of get more with the townsfolk. Like, we have the character of Rebecca, who becomes like the governess, but she has ulterior motives as she feels like perhaps maybe the Boones are a good story for her to write so she can, you know, make money as a writer. So there we go. Got a bit more Stephen King. there's always got to be a writer somewhere. So we have a bit of that. So all these characters that they pretty much have just added to this, you know, we have the constable who, you know, comes into it more as the episodes go on, as well as the minister. And we kind of get to, there's something very evil at Jerusalem's lot, and why Charles Boone's, you know, cousin Stephen and Uncle Philip, or is it the other way around?
It's cousin Stephen, Uncle Philip, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I know I always get things confused. We understand, like, why or how the town just didn't trust them, didn't like them, and how everything kind of ties in. And so he learns about this. He finds out about this book, which I think the translation is The Mysteries of the Worm. I cannot pronounce the Latin title. So as we get more into, like, what this book is, what it means, and, yeah, and then it sort of relates more back to Jerusalem's lot as being where the vampires are, and their leader Jacob wanting the book, and all sorts of interesting intricacies. But I felt like a big heart of the story was between Charles Boone and his three children, Honor, Lower, and Tane, and because they've lost their mother while they're out at sea. So it's just this little family of four. As the series progresses, and obviously this is a spoiler podcast, it's in the introduction, Lower gets turned into a vampire. So she is the one that ends up turning, and it does cause a lot of rift between the family, and seeing where that actually ended up going was very interesting. And there, it does pull at a lot of these little heartstrings as well with this stuff. And it doesn't really hold back. It's there are a lot of very horrific things in this, and we'll actually definitely get into this discussion very soon. But yes, yeah. The thing that terrified me the most with this is, there is a character of Marcella Boone, and people that know me, my real name is Marcella, and it's spelt the same as Marcella because you got the Italian pronunciation. And in the opening credits for every episode, it shows Marcella's grave. So seeing my first name on a grave every episode, just a little bit unsettling. Fun. I never thought I'd see that happen. But there we go.
You know what the creepiest part is, though, Marcy?
Yes, Bede worked something very creepy out, and I don't like this.
Well, she on the gravestone, she died November 4th, so that is about at least a couple of days after your birthday, because you were born October 29th.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the year that she died, I believe, was 1849. So if you move the numbers around, it becomes 1984. 1974, which is the year you and I were both born in.
Well, it's debatable that I was born that long ago. You might have been.
you were born at least 10 years ago, Marcy. Let's just admit that.
Yeah. I'm still 21 at heart, everybody. But, yeah. Yeah, very, very unsettling stuff. But can we talk about some of the truly batshit insane visuals? Let's talk about that baby with no eye and all of that. What was that? Why? That is one thread that went kind of nowhere.
No, not at all. I disagree with you. I hugely disagree with you. That baby was mentioned in the story too, by the way, that
I haven't reread it recently.
That's one of the things that stuck out for me, that there were eyeless and noseless children in the town, and people, like women, it says, gibbering and pointing to the sky for no reason. You know, this was part of the madness that descended on the village of Jerusalem's Lot, I think, not Preacher's Corners, because it's Robert Boone's journal, and it's dated like 1789, which is long before any of this happened. But yeah, the eyeless, noseless child was in the story. But as far as a storyline that went nowhere, the whole, you mentioned before, Charles Boone and his family. But the theme of the whole thing was family. Jacob had a family, right? Minister Burroughs, this eyeless child, was we're told in the beginning that this is his child that he had out of wedlock with Faith Pringle, who was part of Jacob's family, you know, and I use family in the Manson family sort of way there, like a cult, but they were a part of a family. So family was huge in this all the way through. And that baby sort of tied the two families together, the Jerusalem's Lot and Preacher's Corners. But through Minister Burroughs and seeing he was going to take care of this child no matter what, little Henry, and you could see that was the same feeling that Charles Boone had for his his children, his family. As far as, because I kept wondering with Faith Pringle, they take the baby from her, they send her back to the town. We never saw the baby again.
That's what I mean. Like, we don't see it again.
I thought that might have been why, because I wanted to jump back on that and sort of backpedal and say, yeah, maybe that's where you were talking about. Did they eat the baby?
I don't know. We don't know what quite happened. And I'm wondering now, is that going to be something ties into the next season?
Well, that's a thing. It could be. Now that you say that, because I was thinking, like, what did happen to that baby? Because they sort of mentioned...
just not to cut you, I'll let you continue, babe, but just to read, like, Steve's point... Yeah, it is very central to a lot of these plots. So it was kind of disappointing to me that we didn't hear again. Like, we don't know what happened to it after it got taken. But yeah, sorry, Bede, continue. I didn't mean to cut you off.
That's all right. I was going to say, like, basically, like, yeah, the only thing we know what happened to the baby is I can't remember the female familiar of Jacob's, like the one who's like really obsessed with him. And she's like probably a little too... probably way too hot to be like in this movie, but everyone in this series looked believable and fitted the time period. She looked like a supermodel just walked on set.
Yeah, I get what you mean. Everyone looks so dreary, old, run down. She comes along like, are you sure you're in 1850s, love?
Yeah, exactly. And the only thing we know is that she mentions, your baby's gone back to its real father, Jacob. And that's that's the only thing we know. But now that I sort of think about it, now that you said it, Marcy, maybe since now we know there is going to be a second season, maybe the baby will come back into play in the second season. Because I wouldn't think they would have just left that thread unfinished like that unless they come back to it later. Like, if this was, like, say, a miniseries that was just a one-off, they would have at least given us some kind of, like, closure to that plot thread in this story.
I suspect that it was too gruesome and they cut it.
Probably, yeah.
I think when we were talking about season two, I think I was really surprised when I tuned in to watch it again for this podcast, and it said season two coming soon, right? But then watching this again, Charles Boone has a line where I think they planted the seeds early on. He said and I didn't write it down because, you know, I don't do these things, but like he said something about the book needs to be found either by us or in 100 years.
Mm.
And I'm like, oh, I see what you've done there. Right. So they'll bring it back. They won't. My guess is they're not going to bring it back as a direct sequel. It's going to be sort of an anthology show where it won't be connected except maybe through the book or the house, but it'll be set years and years later. I suspect Worm Baby, because a quick Google search does bring me to the question, what the fuck happened to the Worm Baby? So that's what we'll baby. That's what we'll call him. Worm Baby. I suspect that something bad befell Worm Baby, and it was just too maybe gruesome for TV, and they might have
possibly
pulled that because even now I would rather this is like I remember Sam Raimi saying the first time he watched The Hills Have Eyes, you know, and the hill people steal the baby and they're trying to decide, do we raise it as one of ours or do we eat the baby? And Sam Raimi himself thinking, God, please eat the baby. Don't raise it as one of your own, right? And right now in Jerusalem's Lot, everybody's dead.
Mm.
We killed Jacob. We've killed all the vampires. Everybody's gone. Mm. And now we've just got a baby left there to, you know.
Yeah.
What, so yeah. I would much rather they ate the baby than the baby is just out there left to, you know, sort of starve and deteriorate.
Yeah. And we've read and seen lots of horror stories about that kind of stuff happening in real life.
Yeah. Yes. I think they kind of maybe. But yeah, look, I think that'll, as far as the themes go, the family theme, I think that's what Worm Baby was meant to do. Didn't have a button on it. That story didn't have a button, which does irk me. But I think that was the point of it. Yeah.
And I think, you know, sort of when we know that, like, they've got rid of everything in Jerusalem's Lot, at least that what we assume. But yeah, Charles Boone does say that there are probably more out there and perhaps worse than Jacob. So maybe I could sort of see if they had the series kind of lead into Salem's Lot a little bit, but, you know, at least you could, I mean, because we sort of did have the vampires very much there, it lends more as a kind of a prequel or something to the story. At least that's what I felt personally. But yeah, I really did enjoy it overall.
I will be pleased if season two brings in a Mr. Barlow character. I couldn't understand, and this is my problem again with vampires. And I know your listeners out there are going, Steve, shut the fuck up. It's about it's connected to Salem's Lot. It's going to be about vampires. But God damn it, the original story was not. You know, it's either vampires or ancient worm gods. Pick a lane, guys. Mm. Pick a lane, because I think a lot of their vampire mythology was convenient at certain times. Like a lot of the vampires you saw coming from Jerusalem's Lot to destroy, you know, people in the town. They killed the minister's children and all of this, and everyone who was suffering of the sickness, right? They were being fed on by the vampires, right?
The sickness was essentially being the weak from being fed on.
Yeah, exactly, right? And then they died and blah, blah, blah. But these vampires could also come out in broad daylight, okay? So I'm watching this going, oh, well, they dropped that thread. But then in, I think it's episode 5, Constable Dennison says of his wife, Mary, she can't stand direct sunlight. So I'm like, oh, okay, but nobody else, none of the other vampires seem to have a problem with that. So I started going, okay, maybe they're not turned. They're bitten, but they haven't fed off the master yet, right? So they're still sort of halfway in between. Mary, who then becomes full vampire, right? They take the shroud off of her. She spontaneously combusts, as you would expect. But then later on, you see Loa, full vampire, standing in broad daylight again. So it felt to me like I couldn't decide if it was like a Dan Curtis sort of day-night thing where, you know, Dan Curtis just shoots everything, shoots day for night, puts a blue filter on.
Mm.
And you go, okay, we'll accept that it's we'll accept that it's night. Some of these scenes I couldn't decide. what are we supposed to believe here? Do they?
Yeah, it's like, is it direct sunlight? If it's overcast, are you not as affected?
You can
like,
go out in a cloudy day. But
yeah, because they do show like when they transport back with Lola, who is a full vampire, like she's fully covered and stuff like that. So yeah, I was kind of a little bit confused at points. And I don't think that was necessarily intentional or anything.
Right. That's where I feel like they just sort of wedged the vampire thing in.
Yeah, because it was hard to tell like who was an actual vampire or who was one of their minions, or as being said, familiar, which is like their human companion. Yeah, it's a little hard to tell, but I because they kind of had like all the bites, scars everywhere, was a little bit like you could kind of tell. But it took, I think it just took a little bit to kind of get where it was going. But yeah, some of the vampire lore was a bit funny, and I feel like maybe you could explain it that, you know, when they have like the Bible or a cross affects them, is that because it's their false god or what, how does that work? It's because religion does play such a huge part in the thing. Like, I wasn't entirely sure how that aspect was meant to work.
Yeah, because it was vampire lore, they used it. But there was no explanation for why, if the worm was the one, well, the original god, let's say, why any of the Christianity stuff affected them outside of it, you know, being the one true god, which, again, we're talking about mythology here. And going back to the worm as, and this is where the Lovecraft stuff comes in, and I just dig this so much. I mean, he's an elder god. The worm is an elder god. That's fantastic.
As it got to sort of, I think, the last couple of episodes, we felt more of that cosmic type horror.
Yeah.
The sky turn and everything. I feel like we've been chatting a little bit, maybe, I don't know, Bede,
jump in,
do you have any thoughts on the vampire mythology in the show?
Yeah, well, I guess for me, when it talks about whether, you know, there be the worm, the sort of older god, and then, of course, with the vampires still being affected by sort of Christian symbols and stuff like that, I just assume that, like, in my own mind, like, yeah, the worm also exists, but there are also other gods that came afterwards as well. Even like Minister Burrows is like, I can't remember the exact line he says, but it's like, I think Charles Boone's about, you'll have to pray, Minister, and he said, oh, to which god? Because now he's sort of, it's like, he's like, there's more than one. So I think that's what I kind of assume. So there's like more than just one, at least in the universe of this story. So, which I think was pretty interesting. So like all these different gods do exist in the world of this story. And like, so that way, the sort of like crucifixes, holy water, and any other sort of like Christian symbols that we all know and associate with fighting vampires still work in this story as well. I do agree in the sense that it was a little confusing at first, where, because like, it's very, like, sometimes we do see vampires walking around during the day, but others we don't, which was a little confusing to me. But I just assume, like you said, Marcy, just quickly before that, maybe it's because like it was overcast, because most of the time this area near Chapelwaite, it's always overcast, so maybe it's easier for vampires to walk around a little bit.
It is very dreary. That's for sure. And that I think that whole visual of, you know, the House of Chapelwaite and the town of Preacher's Corners, and then Jerusalem's Lot, like, it's so drab, it's so sad. And I feel like that just added so much to the atmosphere of the whole piece. And I really liked that. Like, I thought sort of the set design stuff, how everything just, it felt like that was the time period. The costumes, I thought, were really well done. They really matched that kind of depressing feeling for it all.
The color palette was great. It felt like at times like it was a black and white, like an old black and white film too. Yeah,
it definitely had that. And I think what I kind of appreciate, because there feel like there are elements of sort of like the Dracula and stuff like that, which you know, we know Salem's Lot at least kind of plays a bit like that, at least in terms of probably more so, I guess, the original like Dracula movies and stuff like that with the people coming to town, people turning to vampires, da 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 da. I liked that. And also, yeah, as we mentioned, they kind of do have a little bit of the H.P. Lovecraft in there, but it still feels very King as a whole, which I think was quite good. And yeah, we also, you know, with the religious subject is such a massive thing in this whole series. Like, we do see the characters having the crisis of faith, especially with the minister character, who I felt like, for just a character they pretty much invented for the show, I found him to be one of the more intriguing, interesting, very sympathetic characters. And absolutely, I really did not like how he went out at all.
That wife of his.
I hated the wife, Alice, and I hated her father, Samuel.
Yeah, he was the worst. Oh my God. Yeah.
And the fact that, you know, he still had compassion shown towards him at his final moments. Samuel did not deserve that.
No, he didn't.
At all.
No, he didn't.
But yeah, Alice was the worst. I think absolutely, the testament goes to how that character was written and how well she was portrayed. Like, really,
absolutely.
Alice played the long game in that whole series.
She did, actually.
she was going to kill her husband at some point during that series, and she just waited till like when the whole town needed his guidance and spirituality the most. It was like, no, I'm just going to cut you down as a woman scorn.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's probably not a character we should have really disliked, but you couldn't help it, really. And it's so bad because she was, you know, a woman suffering through the loss of her children, you know, the crumbling of her marriage. But it's almost like the way she goes about it just feels so just, why are you doing this, Alice? This is not the right thing to be doing.
She's just a terrible person. Absolutely. Oh. Just a terrible person. I agree with you, though. I thought Minister Burroughs was great, and I liked Constable Dennison. I thought
liked him as well.
Yeah, a lot of these characters who were, well, yeah, didn't exist in the story at all, were brought in to, you know, to sort of stretch out the story for the series, were great. We're great. And even some of the ones that were, like Thompson is a pulp logger in story. And I guess, be the same in the series here, just before Boone comes in to say, okay, we're going to build ships. We're not going to pulp the stuff. We're going to build ships for the town. Thompson had a much larger role. And Mrs. Cloris, the housekeeper, she was extended. So the secondary characters tertiary characters would be in the story, were given a little more to do, but the characters that they created just for this were, they just outshined these characters.
Yeah, they did. And
I was going to say, they also brought a lot of complexity to those characters to make them well-rounded, like especially with Minister Burroughs going back and forth with his crisis of faith. And
fires before us come for me.
Don't fool yourself, Minister. They're here for all of us. I understand all you've lost. But isn't that when we lean on God the most?
For some. But when Philip Burns' hand was around my throat, his grip was infinite and bottomless. Was the death of everything. I realize that nothing is what I deserve.
That's not true.
It is. Rebecca, you of all people know that I am a fraud. You and your mother.
We never thought of you as a fraud. Just another flawed man. The kind that God favors now and then. The kind who needs him most. Isn't that what you always used to preach?
Empty words.
You don't need faith to fight, Minister, but you do need to fight. If not for yourself, then for something else. May I remind you that there are children in this house, and they deserve more than the next few hours to live.
I And also him kind of decide whether he, like, because everyone in the town is looking for him, the guidance, and he's not even sure if he can or not. And of course, he goes back and forth, and so, moments he does, like, relish getting that faith back, and then points that he sort of is wondering, like, is this even worth it? And then going back and forth. And I think that, to me, is what makes that character very compelling. And also with the constable as well. Like, he's a great character as well, because once his wife becomes a vampire, you're never sure, like, is he going to, like, make a mistake to thinking and then, you know, die along with her?
And
also, like, he, even though she's, like, saying all these things to her to kind of entice him to become a vampire, you're just never really sure if he's going to, like, go through with it or not. And then at the end, it's like, you know, he needs to prove that these things do exist to this town. So he was willing, to his heartache, sacrifice her to show people that, yes, vampires are real and they are coming for us.
I feel like he kind of understands that the woman that was his wife was no longer there.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of these things that, you know, really hit with that family theme, because all the things that are, it's affecting people with their family, like everything that's going on with each person, it has something to do with them, even if it's not direct, if it's with a family member. Like, we have, you know, the character of Rebecca, and we see her mother, and they talk about her long gone father. And this is a character that does show up because he's a vampire, because we find out he was responsible for bringing Jacob to Jerusalem's Lot, or to Maine, or whichever it was.
You know, that's one of the things that that got me, was that this, and it goes back to religion and sort of beyond religion to blind faith and just believing. It was that Samuel had a line. It was just before Mary is you know, burned, I guess. And Charles is explaining that Jacob came to town and turned Stephen and Philip. And Samuel jumps up and says, see, he admits it. His family is responsible for. No. He just said Jacob changed Stephen and Philip. How is it not Jacob's fault? You want to blame Stephen and Philip. So the religion thing comes back there, in that, you know, you can't talk a zealot out of anything. You know, he's just been given the full story, but he still wants to believe what he believes.
But in the end, though, like, the whole town kind of sees it from Boone, from Minister Burroughs, their point of view, that they're right, this guy is completely wrong.
Much of the town does. I think only like 10 guys go with them to fight that. Yeah.
And most of the others sort of stay back at the church, because they knew that's where the best place to be, to be protected. And and also, I got to say, though, like, with that whole entire last episode, like, which is surprisingly that whole section where they actually go and storm Jerusalem's Lot, only goes for like 20 minutes. Although there are some characters' fates that we don't know. Like, they do charge on some vampires, but we never see some of those characters die. We just know it's like, oh yeah, we're the only ones left. It's like, well, show us what happened to the other characters. We don't know if these characters are dead or not.
I mean, I feel like we pretty much know the constable didn't make it, but I think that was about it. Who leaves with them? It's like Abel and the doctor, I think.
Yeah, those are the only two characters.
Besides Boone and Rebecca.
Yeah, I was going to bring that up too, because the climax happens, as you say, Bede, in the first 15, 20 minutes, we're done, you know, and then the rest of it is, you know, just, everything that happens after that. I don't know that, I think it happened too soon. I would have rather some of the buildup that we had at the end of episode 9, that we still, that was transported to 10, because it felt like it was over too quickly. It was too easy a battle, you know. It just took, it took almost no time at all. And then we're left with, you know, 2/3 of the episode just being aftermath, you know, and that's, I thought was too much. I thought it was just too much.
I can definitely say that for sure, but I guess it kind of still, even though, yeah, would have loved to see that expanded more, but I think what happened with the aftermath and what follows afterwards with Boone deciding, like, he has to sacrifice himself to become a vampire, so his family is safe, and also in a what I was not expecting at the time, basically telling the doctor, okay, so when I die, put that book inside me so it stays there.
Yeah. And I'm like, how do you fit that book inside Adrian Brody? He's nothing but a stick.
Exactly. And we're not talking about Adrian Brody in like Predators where he was like big and fit and all that. This is like skinny Adrian Brody in this movie.
This is the pianist Adrian.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like he stepped off the set of The Pianist with no food for a year or something.
Yeah, well, I suppose like if you're a vampire and you're dead, you don't really need any of your vital organs anymore, so they can take them all out. Except for the heart.
I had not considered that. They hollowed him out, put the book in.
They could have, but, you know, that whole sequence of his sacrifice and having to try and explain it to the kids and Rebecca, it's really heartbreaking.
Mm.
And those last moments where they see him go off, like, it's so sad. Because you've really grown to love these characters. And I got to say, I thought the three performances of the children were really damn good. Oh, yeah,
they were fantastic.
Kids were great.
And, you know, normally it can be difficult to have really strong performances from kids, and it's not any fault of the kids, they're kids, you know what I mean? Mm. But they actually really delivered. There was so much heart in there.
Yeah, I thought little Tane was really good.
He was great. Adorable. Yeah. He really was. And I felt like he felt just so genuine, like his actions when he kind of betrays them because he wants to save his family and it was his sister that told him. And, oh, you just feel for him. It's that really, really just wonderful performances. Sorry, I feel like I keep cutting you off.
Babe. That's all right. I was going to say what another thing I think is interesting about the series, especially with the kids, is that the writers of the series decided to make Boone's children of, you know, biracial children as well. So you can see like, yeah, they come to this town and sort of the racial prejudice that these kids face being in this town, even though, yeah, I mean, they're half white, but they're still being treated like, you know, this
savage,
like as savages. Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of lends even more to kind of the hostility of the townspeople. Because not only are they extremely racist, they already don't like Charles Boone because of his cousin and uncle.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And now they're like, well, he's got these children that we don't approve of, blah, blah, blah. And in very Stephen King fashion, they're bullied.
Yeah.
Ugh. I wanted to punch those kids, let me tell you. Leave Laura alone.
See, these are all the elements I was telling you about, that they all these Stephen King elements that we have seen many times before, they weaved into this story.
Yeah. I like, they did it in a way that, worked.
And felt organic to what
it felt organic. I look at Castle Rock and I'm thinking, yeah, we didn't need Jackie Torrance in this. Mm. You know, like there are certain things like, oh, we have to make a reference to The Shining. Well, why? It's Castle Rock. There's literally no connection here. They just sort of wedge things in there because, hey, Stephen King, you know? And this felt very like, Marcy, what you mentioned, that the scene where he's explaining to the kids what's going down, that's very King. That's very, very King. And there's nothing like that in the original story at all. But they did. They managed to make it feel King, where there really was none to start with.
Yeah, which I thought was really, really good. And yeah, as much as it really felt like, you know, looking at this, you could have thought this was a whole novel of material from Stephen King. And it having such a King feel to it, I think just kind of adds to it because it really feels like they were just kind of expanding on this little world he'd created with that story. And it, as you said, it's done in a really good way, a very natural way. It doesn't, I don't think it does any disservice to the short story or anything like that. I just feel like it was almost a very natural way to kind of expand that story.
Yeah. Yeah, not at all. I do feel that they didn't lawnmower man it. You know what I mean? Like they didn't have their own story and they just sort of wedged references to Jerusalem's Lot in here. They really did. They expanded the story and the entire short story, save, you know, poor Cal, I guess. There's no the Calvin character I did miss. I thought Abel could easily have been named Calvin and, you know, that would have paid service to that. But it was this story sort of pulled apart and put back together again. It was great.
Yeah.
Minus the vampires.
Yeah.
Well, sorry. Yeah. Sorry. I'm not letting that go.
You're not, and we know you. I'm and like you shouldn't.
A terrier with a rag toy on that one. I will not let that go. But...
Well, I gotta say, I don't know if you both noticed this, but I liked the little reference to Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game in the show. Do you remember what I'm referring to?
I actually don't.
I do not.
I probably did not even think about it.
Well, you know when Charles Boone touches the book for the first time and he has that future of what the vampires taking over the world would look like?
The eclipse.
Yeah, the eclipse, because it's a red, blood-red sky. And we've seen that before in both Dolores Claiborne, well, the film adaptations of Dolores Claiborne and Gerald's Game.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
So is this maybe like when that eclipse was happening, that was like at that time when those stories were
yes.
set?
Oh, geez.
Every time there's an eclipse, something happens.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly.
To be fair, they kind of, you know, when we do see the actual eclipse later, that was conjured by Jacob reading the book.
Well, that is true, yes. But that was a different type of eclipse. That was one that's just
it was a total eclipse of the heart.
But it could have been happening across it could have been happening across every universe, you see. Mm. So he could have been pulling them all together. This is the cosmic horror of
it. Well, that was that whole visual of the night sky as it was turning. It was such an amazing visual because it's like the moon's gone. It's just like this black hole and all the stars are going towards it. You can even see some stars or maybe planets exploding as well as all this. And I thought that was such an amazing visual.
That was a great effect.
Mm. Yeah, this thing is quite a visual experience as well. It really gives you so much to look at and admire, as well as being kind of terrifying at points as well. And this is kind of... I mean, it is like 10 episodes and, yeah, it does kind of slow burn for a lot, which I really like because you get to know who the people are, the town, the characters and everything. But, yeah, it's this very, very mysterious and kind of terrifying ride. And I just kind of go off in tangents that make no sense when I'm talking. So.
I find the same, though, too. So I'll be going off on something. I'm like, what? What point am I trying to tie back to with this? So
yes, I don't know. It just worked for me for the most part.
I keep saying it worked. I keep saying it worked for me, and then I keep bringing up things I didn't like. So I hope I'm not contradicting myself here. But like Jacob, for example, was very, very much the classic Nosferatu. Very much a Mr. You know, sort of a Mr. Barlow type. That sort of thing. But you know, coherent and could speak. But why? Like, was that because he was like 2,000 years old, or like we never really got anything on that? It's just like, oh, look, he's the lead vampire, therefore, blah blah blah. I thought if he's drinking all this blood, he's got to look like Jerry fucking Dandridge. He's got to look suave, you know. It's got to be really.
Maybe he got turd when he was old. See, these are the two things that would suck if you're a vampire, because if you got bitten as a vampire and turned into one as a child, you have to be a child forever. If you do that as an adult, if you do that as an old person, you have to be an old person forever.
Absolutely. You know what, Pete? I'll accept it. I'll accept it. He was 93 when he got turned. Dude, I'm in.
Yeah. Either absolutely. That or the blood sources are just really crap and lacking everything. It just doesn't rejuvenate him very well. But I actually thought his appearance was quite unnerving. I didn't like. I was like, I don't want to look at
it. But have you seen the actor? Do you know Christopher Heyerdahl?
Yes, I've actually seen him in person.
He's a little unnerving himself.
He is. Like, he is.
He's like a I don't know, an elongated version of Lance Henriksen. You know, he's kind of horrifying. So to put that makeup on him, the stringy hair, the eyes, and then the rat teeth, which I loved. Yeah, it really does elevate that creepiness, isn't it?
And I'm just like looking up his filmography, both his film and TV, and he's been in everything. And
he has other
vampire stuff too. Marcy, he was in Catwoman.
Yeah, that does not surprise me.
Like, he was in the Twilight films, he was in Blade Trinity. He was in the Black Cat episode of Masters of Horror as well, Marcy.
There you go.
Was he?
Yes.
I can't remember what he was in.
Who'd
that.
Who'd he play in that?
It says here he played a character named Rufus Griswold.
He played Griswold? I'm sorry. I just came off a play I'd written about Poe, so it was like all in Poe form. Poe Griswold was the guy who he was Poe's enemy in life.
Oh yes, now I'm sort of picturing who he was in the episode, but I think I have an idea who he was in that episode now.
He got to write Poe's obituary for some reason, ended up with the rights to Poe's stories, wrote his obituary, and is the reason we think of Poe as just a besotted alcoholic all the time, because that's what Griswold wrote.
Interesting.
Motherfucker.
Anyway. And also he was in Kingdom Hospital as well.
Oh, there you go.
I thought he was really well cast. I felt like he really just was so good as Jacob. Like, I found the whole thing quite unnerving from how they did the makeup to how his performance was. Mm. And I think we've said, like, I think everyone in this, like, was really good.
And also, like, Marcia, we've talked about when we were talking about both the 70s and 2000s versions of Salem's Lot, like, we talked about how the Barlow in the 70s version was very effective because it was almost like this animalistic, you know, Max Schreck style Nosferatu. But we were kind of underwhelmed with Rutger Hauer's interpretation of the character because, I mean, he was just a normal dude as a vampire. So I think what's great about Jacob in this one is like it sort of combines those two together. Like he's definitely more Nosferatu in this one, but yet has that kind of like can speak in hush, low tones as Rutger Hauer did in the 2000 versions.
He brings a lot of charisma that you can kind of see how people would be drawn in.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Which I think really worked as well.
Yeah. And also supermodels joining his familiars. There you go.
Well, yeah, why wouldn't you? They probably had the best tasting blood too.
Well, that is true, yes. And I like how basically, like at some point, the vampires have like a literal drug den. They're just, the familiars just go in there, lie down. It's like, oh, just suck me and just get it over and done with.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, completely. And when she comes out of feeding, she's just sort of like, you know, willowy and falling onto door frames and things like that.
Mm. And it's funny too, is when you had mentioned earlier, Stephen, like that sort of like Jacob's family is kind of very Manson-esque. Like when Faith died and she gets stabbed to death, that was the first thing that popped into my head when all that was happening.
Same here.
Yeah, Sharon Tate.
So it was.
It's very brutal too. And you feel very sorry for her.
Oh, yeah. Even though she was only in a few episodes, like she was a very well rounded character and her relationship with Minister Burrows wasn't, you know, one of the strongest relationships in the series. And you could tell there was a lot of love. She was just taken out in such a horrible way that you definitely felt something when she was killed.
It sort of like we kind of weren't sure who was going to make it to the end of this. And I actually like that when you have that sense of you really don't know who's going to make it. Kind of to me it's a bit more compelling, whereas if you kind of can guess very easily who's not going to make it, it's not quite the same. So that's another thing I think I really appreciated with the series.
I was just looking up now because we're sort of like thinking like where would season two go when it was announced that it was going to happen. There is a slight little synopsis for the second season.
Oh,
well, right. It's not really much, but it just basically says here, and I'm reading this off Variety. It says, Chapel Waite is based on Stephen King's short story, Jerusalem's Lot. Season one debuted in 2001, and the new season will reveal the Boone family's curse didn't die with Jacob, and that the book, which name I can't say, but Stephen can say
probably. Mysterious?
Exactly.
Mysterious?
Yes. Yeah. And the book remains as powerful as ever. So it sounds, from the sounds of it, the curse has an ender. But here's what I would like to see for the second season. I would like to see, like if Adrian Brody does come back, oh, well, he have to because he's got the book. He comes back to Chapel Waite, but I think Hanna and Tane, they should be adults by the time he comes back. But Loa's still, of course, you know, still the vampire child. That would be something I think would be interesting. Like, say, like maybe 15 or 20 years has passed or something like that.
I guess we'll have to wait and see and obviously then determine if we talk about it on this particular podcast. I'm sure we can just talk about it in general. But
yes.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious to kind of see where it ends up going. Because, yeah, I think it is a really compelling world that they've kind of built around this and how, I guess, they've captured the story of Jerusalem's Lot. But I guess we probably, I don't know if we have too much more we can say, but you will get your opportunity. Bede, what are your final thoughts and rating out of 5 for season 1 of Chapelweight?
If I had to give the whole season a rating, I'd give it a solid 3.5 out of 5. I think it's a really solid and strong horror series. Like I stated before, I don't think it necessarily needed to be 10 episodes long. Like, it could easily have been 8. And so that way, some of the more sort of plot threads that kind of dragged a little bit would have been a little bit more tighter. But that being said, though, I still think it's really well made. It's got a lot of atmosphere. It's very creepy. And also the performances and the characters are what sort of really elevated it to me. And, you know, which for me made it such a compelling viewing experience as a whole, but also makes me very interested to see where the second season will go as well.
Mm. Stephen, what are your final thoughts and rating out of 5?
I thought it was good. Out of 5, I give it a 4. I give it a 4 because of the characters and the story and the themes. Mm. I thought were all really strong. Like you said, Bede, I really enjoyed Minister Burroughs and his story and the way everything worked in. And, you know, there's one family versus another family, the way the vampires were portrayed, sort of like we talked about, as a cult, you know, coming in and destroying this town. I dug it. I really did. I do think it could be done. And I wonder if there's a way to do a fan edit to just take out a lot of the vampire stuff.
Like, there probably would be.
You know what I mean? Like, because there's enough of the cult of the book to get us there. You know, the book, the De Vermis Mysterious is enough reason to be concerned. You know, people being sacrificed to the worm, that sort of thing, without the vampire thing. So that loses a couple of notches there for me. But I do think it was a good solid story in that regard.
And as for me, I give this one a 4 out of 5 eyeless and noseless babies. I really, really enjoyed the season overall, and it captured my attention. There was a lot of heart-wrenching moments. There's a lot of very horrific moments. And I think overall it flowed really well. I think I'm with you both. They probably could have trimmed down some of it a little bit and, yeah, maybe extended the final standoff. That would have been quite good as well. But, yeah, overall I was very, very impressed. I really liked this one. And, yeah, highly recommend it to those who haven't yet seen it. And we've spoiled the whole thing for you, but there we go.
You know, I was going to say, now that I think about it, when you said like eyeless, noseless, earless babies, I sort of thought, and almost, if they just did the mouth, it could have been see no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
The baby did have a deformed mouth with the nose.
Oh, that is true. So, that is very true. So,
and like, yeah, half arm or something, I don't know.
Yeah, it was kind of like, it wasn't even, there was no fingers on its little baby arm.
Yeah, it was all something.
Poor worm baby. Poor worm baby.
Little worm baby. But yes, that concludes this month's episode of the Kingzone podcast. Thank you, Bede and Stephen, for joining me for this episode.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome.
And thanks for letting me just come back again and not firing me, Marcy.
Yeah, and thanks for you to putting up with me for some of the recording issues.
Yes.
Yes, but as it stands now, the next episode of The King Zone, we will be taking a look at the latest of the Stephen King things to come out, at least as of recording, with the new Firestarter as well as 1408.
Indeed. And we have a very special guest lined up for that one as well.
Yes, we do. So look forward to that one. And Steve and I will be back on the King Zones Book Club podcast as well. And Steve, which 2 short stories will we be looking at for that next episode?
We're looking at The Cat from Hell and a very little known. I mean, The Cat from Hell isn't well known, but it's known more than Man with a Belly.
Looking forward to that one. So lots of Stephen King goodness for you lovely listeners. And you can always check us out at supermarcy.com. If you type in the King Zone podcast or the King Zones Book Club podcast on your podcast player, you should find it right there. And we have handy links over at supermarcy.com or our link tree, which is linktr.ee/thesupernetwork. And if you want to find me and say hello, I'm available on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy, or you can keep up to date with whatever I'm watching and all the podcast lists that I have on Letterboxd at super_Marcy. Abid, what about for you?
Well, people want to find me personally. They can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeJamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BeJamine. And of course, you can find all my work over at supermarcy.com with my reviews and columns.
Absolutely. Everything is in the show notes. And Steve, I don't think you have anything to promote at the moment.
No.
I don't know. There we go.
I'm unfindable. No. I'm not. I can pitch my theater company.
Go for it.
All right. You can find us at thenacktheater.com. The Knack with a K. Well, two Ks, but not, you know, right next to one another. And find me at Letterboxd as Fulcirama.
Very nice, very nice. And yes, with that said, we will catch you all on the other side of the King Zone. Bye-bye, everybody.
See you, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN. Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised. A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show. Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal. You can also find the link in the show notes. Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy Shark, do 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 do. Surfy Shark, do 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 do. And now back to the show.